Hello. The day of this episode's release is Super Bowl Sunday in the States. This is a good time to talk about sports ball on Doctor Who literature. Super Bowl Sunday, this year Super Bowl 58, is the biggest sports day of the year in the United States, the day of monster TV ratings where it costs $7 million for a single 30-second TV ad. Legends are made with those ads. The Super Bowl games themselves used to routinely end in lopsided blowouts like 38-9 or 55-10, until about 25 years ago, when almost every game seems to miraculously be up in the air until the very final play. This year's game between the Kansas City Chiefs, one of the best NFL teams of the past 5 years, and the San Francisco 49ers, one of the best NFL teams of the last half century, are playing in America's biggest betting event, an estimated $23 billion economy, and they're playing outside of Las Vegas, America's gambling capital. The game this year has added cultural and political resonance, as one of the Chiefs' best players is dating Taylor Swift, the most famous woman in America, if not in the world, herself a billion-dollar economy, who, as big as the NFL is, plays concerts in more NFL arenas and in front of more fans per year than any single NFL player does in any given season. America's right wing is on edge with the ascendance of this left-leaning power couple. And while I've deleted Twitter, I have learned through cultural osmosis that various self-described alpha males, that's a term no one would self-apply where I come from, are peddling conspiracy theories or threatening boycotts. None of that will alter the game's bottom line by a single penny. Super Bowl Sunday is America's biggest secular holiday. But I'm not here to talk about the NFL. Myself, not really a football fan, and these days the Super Bowl is the only game that I watch each year. New York City's two former NFL teams both decamped to New Jersey decades ago. Most NFL team owners are repugnant people. Read up on Jerry Jones or Robert Kraft or Woody Johnson sometime for some horrific details. And yes, there really is a billionaire, courtesy of that hard-earned generational wealth. His real name is Robert Wood Johnson IV. And he really does go by Woody Johnson. Most of this about the NFL is not important, with the exception of Taylor Swift. What is important is that word, sports ball. It's a word you often see online in the sci-fi fantasy community to impugn sports. Sports, multi-billion dollar industries like American football, soccer, basketball, hockey, or what used to be the big three sports, which now really don't register but are still out there somewhere, baseball, boxing, and horse racing, not to mention Donald Trump's favorite sports leagues, the UFC and the WWE, as if all of this can be condensed into one single dismissive word, sports ball, then ignored by our fantasy and sci-fi fandoms. We have our tribe, sports ball fans have theirs, they don't like us, so we're not going to like them. This breakdown is historically not the case. There used to be a near one-to-one Venn diagram overlap of sports fans and sci-fi fans. When my father grew up in Brooklyn, he was 13 the year the Dodgers moved cross-country to Los Angeles, and he became a hardcore Yankees fan. All the boys were baseball crazy in summer, and monster movie crazy the rest of the year. My father is the guy who bought a VCR before anyone else on our block, so he could record off-air 1950s sci-fi movies showing on out-of-town TV stations at 4 in the morning, but he never missed an inning of Yankees baseball. I grew up being routinely quizzed on both dialogue from Forbidden Planet and the 1961 Yankees starting lineup. I rarely use it myself, sir. It promotes rust. Bobby Richardson, Tony Kubek, Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, Elston Howard, Moose Scourin, Yogi Berra, Clete Boyer. Nice planet you have here. High oxygen content. And people of my father's generation and younger generations continue to mix both fandoms. Star Trek Deep Space Nine did a baseball episode. The Munsters did a baseball episode. X-Files, baseball episode. Speaking of the X-Files, the reason the two lead characters in later seasons were called Scully and Doggett were because the Brooklyn and then L.A. Dodgers' two lead broadcasters for decades, Vin Scully, Jerry Doggett. Star Wars author Jason Fry, he of multiple nonfiction books, and also the novelization of Episode 8, a movie hated by the same people who are boycotting the Super Bowl because Taylor Swift was going to be there. Jason Fry is also one of the most prolific and best known and earliest bloggers about my favorite sports team, the New York Mets. Me, I've been acknowledged in both Doctor Who books and the 1998 edition of the Baseball Prospectus, and I'm a dues-paying member of the Society for American Baseball Research. Their publications, by the way, are the baseball equivalent of Obverse Books' Black Archive series. So for me, there's no sports ball. There's no tribal allegiance to one fandom or the other. I am here for both. Super Bowl Sunday will find me recording both a Trap 1 episode about 1960s Doctor Who, and then watching the game and the commercials. Later this year, the family is making an extra-long pilgrimage so that two of us can go see Taylor Swift live in concert. Let's play ball, and let's get to it.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason. A reminder, a few days after this episode releases, I will be at Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles. I believe my 9th time going to that convention. I will be speaking on 2 panels on Friday, the first full day of the con. I will be on a panel about podcasting, and I'll be moderating the Deathmatch Doctor Who 6460 panel. You'll also be able to find me on the SCED app, so you know where I'll be. I will definitely be at the podcasters meetup on Friday afternoon, and of course I will be there both days on Saturday and Sunday with a slightly larger entourage than usual. If you are at Galley, come find me and say hello. I hope to be recording 3 upcoming book interviews live at the convention, as well as getting several other interviews with friends, fans, and podcasters, and other people that I happen to meet along the way who are amenable to quick recordings on my cell phone camera. I am recording several episodes out of order over the next few months in order to accommodate people that I'll be seeing live at Galley. I interviewed Graham Burke for this week's episode, The Twin Dilemma, Target Book Number 103, a few days ago. I did mentally lose track of where I was in the recording order, so when you listen to my interview with Graham, there will be a little bit of confusion entirely on my part as to what episodes are coming out when. But yes, this is the last episode that I am recording before Galley. Several other interviews over the next few months on this show will have been recorded out of order, but Twin Dilemma was recorded the same week that the episode is dropping. So, let's get to it.
Hi, I'm Rupert Booth.
I am known as Paul Ferry.
And my name is Barry Williams.
Together, we host Time Ram.
Time Ram's a cruel mistress.
It's a random number generator.
That also.
We roll a number from 1 to 13, and that's our doctor. Then 1 to 300 for the story, and then we ram them together.
Even if it doesn't make sense.
Cruel, I tell you.
Time Ram, putting the wrong doctors in the wrong stories, so you don't have to.
You're listening to Doctor Who Literature.
All right, welcoming back one of the hardest working men in podcasting, Graham Burke. Welcome back to the show.
I don't know. I think you and Jim Sangster have taken that crown away from all of us, but that's okay. but thank you all nonetheless.
I think Jim works harder on this podcast than I do because he's been on like 4 of the last 6 episodes, and he does all the music and he designed my logo. So I don't put in that much effort. I just show up.
I dispute that, but I know better than to argue with, so I'm not going to bother.
You know that I have a legendary 6 or 7 week podcast backlog. Yeah. And I just so happened to reach your Reality Bomb 60th Anniversary Essentials 2-parter as I was facing a 2.5-hour drive from Atlanta to Chattanooga the last week of 2023 between Xmas and New Year's.
Oh, wow.
And it's two episodes a week apart, so I should not have listened to them consecutively. But for you, the first episode was so good, I was desperate to get to part two. So I listened to both back to back, not least because the first guest in part two happens to be yours truly, and I wanted to hear how terribly I came across. However, you have magic editing fingers, so you actually managed to make me sound good. So I certainly do thank you for that.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. It was a delightful conversation. It turned out to be a great little experiment. I sort of went in kind of going, I'm not quite sure how this is all going to turn out. And yeah, I was actually pleasantly surprised myself by it all, actually.
So I've got two questions for you, reality bomb wise. And the first one is the question that you and Joy Piedmont ask each other every month. What are you drinking right now? Because I can see a dark amber beverage in your hand.
That is correct. I do have a dark amber beverage. I'm drinking my standard go-to drink, which is a Macallan, which is I believe a Macallan 12-year-old. And I do have some actually really nice scotch upstairs. I got like multiple bottles of scotch for Christmas this year. It was actually quite wonderful. And I have not drank any of them because I still like I have a third of a bottle of Macallan that I want to finish. So I don't like having multiple bottles of scotch. I start one, I finish it, and then I go to the next one. I'm very sequential like that. But yeah. So anyways.
If only I could apply the Burkean philosophy of scotch to my books. Because I have multiple books going at once. Some of them I start, love them, and then just get sidetracked and don't finish. I've got like four or five books on my bed table that I need to finish, and that I love them all, but the next one comes along and it's so shiny, and I'll get to the other one, and it just never happens, and it's very sad.
I got about four going on too. I don't have that philosophy towards my book reading either. It's very tragic. I've had like John Irving is my favorite author, and I literally have had his latest book going for over a year and a half now. So yeah, and I'm like 2/3 of the way through it. So that's great. My reading speed has just declined, and my reading opportunities have declined. And honestly, you know. It's less comfortable to read on a bus than it was when I was at the age when I'm, you know, was reading Target novels, as a teenager. I read half my books on the bus, and the older I get, the less I like reading on the bus to work. So I don't.
The motion sickness with the bouncing, I'm sure.
But yeah, there's that.
I have the same issue because before the pandemic, I had a 45-minute set of subway rides to the office and a set of 45-minute subway rides home from the office. Plus, I would often read on my lunch break. So I could have one book on the commute in and a second book on the commute home, and I finished both inside of a week, and everybody was happy. Thanks to the pandemic, I basically stopped reading books during the pandemic, and I was spending more time either gaming on my phone or reading my news aggregators to distract myself. And even now with the telework, I'm only in the office a handful of days a month, so my reading time is substantially diminished. And if I'm on the subway now, I'm listening to podcasts trying to clear out my, like the Augean stables, I'm trying to clear out my 7-week backlog, and it never gets any shorter. So I need to physically make time to read. So for 2024, the year of the presidential election, I've put myself on a news diet, and I have to stop reading my news aggregators, and I'm trying to cut back on my ridiculous telephone game habits. So
those all sound healthy. I just have to deal with, you know, impending, you know, my eyes are just older than they used to be. So I just don't like reading as much. I used to love it. I used to do it all the time, and now I can't.
My vision is also going the way of Anthony Stevens' draft script for The Twin Dilemma.
Indeed. Oh, that's a topical reference given what we're talking about tonight, but yes.
But my second question, reality bomb-wise, and I want to point out to you that this week, because I'm recording a bunch of episodes live at Gallifrey One next week, I am reading Time Lash and Galaxy 4. And The Seeds of Death out of order and Twin Dilemma all in the same week. Wow. So call me the Gelf and pity me, because this has been a week that tries my love of reading.
I'm so sorry, but you know, I dearly love the Twin Dilemma novelization, so I see nothing wrong with it. But the other three, Time Lash, boy howdy, that's a slog of a read. I remember just Galaxy 4 just being blandly inoffensive. I really liked it because it was split. He was lazy enough to just split the chapters in by episode. So, you know, it's like, oh wow, this is cool. I get to the end of Airlock and I'm on to the next one. It's great. I thought 400 Dawns. It's great. So yeah.
See, what's funny is we are recording this before I release my Galaxy 4 episode, so you have not heard it yet, but that point is already preserved in my script, because as a kid, I wanted to know where the cliffhangers, and Galaxy 4 makes it very, very easy. The prose is not bad. It's not like Terrence Dick's level sparkling, but there's just so much casual misogyny in the book. So there's lots of really wicked lines about what William Ems thinks of the female species, and
that's true.
Are a bit uncomfortable.
It has not aged well. I will admit that. I did do a thumb through it recently, and I was like, that's unfortunate.
And my guest for that one was/will be Stacy Smith. So I'm very curious to know what she is going to think of it/what she already said on last week's show.
That is an odd choice for her, I have to say. I didn't even know she liked this particular novelization.
She wanted to do one for each doctor on this show, and this was a story that was only available as telesnaps, and then the surviving episode comes out and blows us all away. So I think she'll have a lot to talk about.
No good. Well, I look forward to hearing it.
And to my listeners who have already heard it, we hope you enjoyed it.
We hope you enjoyed it.
So what was the idea for your Essentials episode? It's 10 segments per episode, 20 segments total for the Essential episodes of Doctor Who's first 60 years. How did that come to be, and how did you find your guest?
Oh gosh. It wasn't my idea. I will freely credit that. It actually is an old friend of ours, Richard Salter, and my friend Scott Clark. They did a fiction fanzine called Mythmakers. I edited a Doctor Who fanzine called Enlightenment, which was a straight up current fanzine about Doctor Who, the TV show. It was factual and ish. And I edited that for 10 years. And it had a sister zine that was a fiction zine. And Richard and Scott edited that together. And for the 40th anniversary of Doctor Who, because we are old, Jason, they did back in 2003, Richard and Scott had the idea of doing something about the essentials of Doctor Who. And basically it was partially marketing gimmick on their part, because Richard, if anyone's met him, knows that he is a lovely man and a talented writer. And he is one of the greatest marketing geniuses in Doctor Who fandom there was back in the day. And Richard had this brilliant idea that what he could do was he could like ask all kinds of people, you know, what do you think is an essential element of Doctor Who? And then he could like promote to the hell out of the fact that all these people answered his question, and then have a bunch of stories that sort of illustrated an element of it. So he got like, I think he got Terry Pratchett to answer. I know he got Neil Gaiman to answer. Wow. And Neil Gaiman basically said, well, I kind of said it in my Telus novella introduction, so I don't really know what we're talking. But, you know, and he got famous for Doctor Who people like Paul Cornell to answer, and he got people who were had worked on the show previously, and people who were kind of well-known science fiction and fantasy authors to go answer this question of what are the essential elements. And I wrote a story for it called The Third Book of the Doctar. And I did because my essential element of Doctor Who is normally in normal time, the fact that Doctor Who is a very secular show. And I did Doctor Who is scripture. I did a story where it's just all told like scripture, where basically the Doctor battles the Master. and it's all done in kind of ancient writing. So that was my contribution to it. And it was great. And I forgot about it for 20 years. And then we came to the 60th, and I think we were doing an episode of Reality Bomb, and we were doing a live Zoom show, which is a lot of fun. And I needed a panel to get people kind of, you know, talking about things. And I thought, oh, this Essentials idea is kind of fun. Let's go bring it up as the topic. And it did really well. People had some really great things to say. And I thought it was a lot of fun. And then we came to the 60th anniversary. And I thought, you know, I'd like to come back to that Essentials idea, because I felt like we could do a lot more with that. And I suddenly had the idea, well, you know, we could do this as like mini essays, you know, where we sort of quote, you know, where we have the person talk, but we cut it up and we sort of do it as an individual style thing, and where they're talking to the microphone themselves. And then we splice in clips from Doctor Who and we add music, and it's great. You know, it's kind of basically the introductions I do for the music podcast I do with Shannon Dohar and Rob Jones, Deeper Cuts, where we basically do a what we call a vox pop, where we interview some person and ask them about an album that influenced them. And I splice in music from it and just have them talking. So I just said, let's do it for Doctor Who. And how I selected them kind of just was an organic process. I knew I wanted to get you. I knew there's some people I just wanted to have on it. And then I kind of, and there were some people from the previous episode I wanted to use again. And then there was a couple of things. And then it just kind of evolved. I remember I went back to Scott to go do it, because I wanted to tie it in with the original collection. And I just contacted people that I just thought would be fun that I haven't talked to in ages, and thought, you know, like I wanted to hear what Bill Evenson had. And Bill Evenson had Tom Baker as his essential element. As
I was pounding the steering wheel in glee during Bill's segment. Love that.
As is well and proper. So yes, it was very good. And you know, there's just a couple of moments where it was just like, oh, this, I just loved how it evolved. Like I had two people do Hope. And they did it from two separate perspectives, and it was kind of amazing. And I just thought, well, that's great. And I just loved how it kind of nicely evolved. And somewhere along the line, I thought to myself, well, you know what? It isn't Doctor Who anniversary unless you basically use archival footage to your advantage. So we had a feature that lasted for all of two episodes called Doctor Who and A to Z, which had, you know, people talking about a letter of the alphabet and some connection with Doctor Who. And we did one with, I think we did the first one with my old friend Petra Mayer, and who died a couple of years ago. And so I just thought, well, I've still got the original tapes for that. Why don't I just try and use what she did and make it into that? So that kind of came together nicely. And it was just one of those things that the more I talked to people about it, the more goodwill there was. Like I just remember talking to Lacey Bugger and Alice about it. And she was just so delighted that we were doing this. And Sage Young was the same way. It was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Let's go. Let's do this. So yeah, that's kind of how it evolved. I loved it.
And not to tell tales out of school, but my segment on the show was not the first one that you and I recorded.
No, it was not. Yes. Oh, God. That was a tortured evolution, wasn't it? I'm so sorry. Well, you're not
your fault at all. I had no idea. Joy Peep, I used to work in my neighborhood. I used to be able to see her school from my office window. I haven't spoken to her in a while. I was not aware that she and I were going to give the exact same answer with the exact same structure and the exact same examples and anecdotes. I had no idea that was going to happen.
As soon as I realized that's what it was, I was like, yeah, I think I'll go with Joy's. Partially because I knew that you had this amazing anecdote, which we had recorded for a previous show. We were going to do a documentary on doing the pilgrimage, and it was sort of a project I was doing during the pandemic, and I never quite finished because I was kind of documentaried out, because I was making a documentary podcast at the time, and never quite did it. But you have the most amazing story about, you know, comparing, you know, the first episode of Doctor Who that was broadcast on 23 November 1963 with, you know, the fifth anniversary of Doctor Who was broadcast on 23 November 1968, which was the invasion, episode four or something like that. And I just thought, well, that's such an amazing anecdote. There's something to be made out of that. So I went back to you and had you record it. And then we lost the recording. So we had to record it all over again. Which was fortunate, because Jason has the most eidetic memory of anybody I know. Like, you know, like television, whenever I say television characters, you know, say they have eidetic memories, I go, oh, that's just such a TV trope. And then I think to myself, oh, Jason Miller. And I go, yeah, well, there you go.
All right. First of all, thank you. Second of all, your memory of my eidetic memory dates back to 25 years ago when I had this encyclopedic recollection of Rekar's Doctor Who posts and private emails. Now that I am on the far side of 30, if you know what I mean, yes, that faculty is rapidly leaving me. And I will tell you that for you, when I record for your show, I take notes. And I don't script out my answers, but I give myself bullet points. So I was able to reopen that list of bullet points and go back and recreate most of what I had said.
It was a very, very almost letter perfect reproduction of what you had done, which was really amazing. So it was third time lucky. And you were the MVP of that special, I have to say. Thank you. And it was genuinely really, really fun. And it was one of those things that really took me by surprise because I wasn't. I don't think I knew when I actually listened to it, and I listened to all 20, I was just so moved by it. It was because it was just like this wide breadth of fan experience and really, really cool people talking about things. And it just really moved me. So, and I made it. So maybe that says I'm just a massive egotist, but also it just impressed me how broad and deep and beyond the small screen Doctor Who fandom is, to poach a phrase.
It is a titanic achievement, and if you have not listened to it, I'll link to it in the show notes if I can remember, eidetic memory or not. And the fact that you edited it so well with the musical cues in between, it's very professionally sounding as opposed to my show. And Barsky is always after me to hire a real editor who knows what they're doing as opposed to myself. But you also, this is another problem, the facility that I lack is brevity, and you were able to keep each guest down to a certain number of minutes, and it's very compact. And I will tell you that I instantly regretted my – once Bill opens his mouth and says Tom Baker, I'm like, I was it. I should have gone with that. I gave the wrong answer. That's the perfect answer. That is the – Tom Baker is the essential element of – all due respect to everybody who came before and after. That's the answer. That is the answer right there.
Yeah. As soon as he said it, I was like, oh yeah, that's just absolutely perfect. And it's one of those ones where, you know, I tried to keep myself out of the interview as much as humanly possible, but that was one I just had to be in it right from the get-go, because it was just like, I was so taken by surprise by it. I felt like I needed to be there to be a stand-in for the listener.
We are all stand-ins in Bill's life, and it's his journey, and we're just along for the ride.
It's true. It's true. My wife has spoken to like two people in Doctor Who fandom extensively over the years, and is you and Bill, which is very, very strange. She always inquires after you and Bill, which is hilarious. Oh, and Kim Rogers, but that's because they watch The Bachelor. But you and Bill are the only like two men in Doctor Who fandom that she ever asks me questions, you know, and asks how you both are doing. So, and I will likely go upstairs and when I finish this recording, and she'll say, oh, you talked to Jason. How is he? So, yes. So.
Hopefully you guys make it back down to New York, or I make it to Canada at some point, and we can all three of us hang out.
Either would be lovely. Yes, we're hoping to come to New York, I think, this spring. So watch the space.
Absolutely. So we're about almost 20 minutes into this hour-long conversation, and we've managed to avoid the subject. So I will preface the next bit, and I've been doing this a lot lately, and I'll have to stop at some point, but I'm going to dip into Darren Mooney's The 250 podcast, and I'm going to ask you the three questions that he asks all of his guests about every movie on the show. But instead of asking if this belongs on a list of the 250 greatest movies of all time, since we're at the 60th anniversary, does The Twin Dilemma, the TV story, belong on a list of the 60 greatest Doctor Who TV stories of all time?
Absolutely not. It's placed at the bottom of the Doctor Who 250th, at the bottom of just about every single Doctor Who poll known to human history, is deserved. I don't think it's bad, but I don't think there's any Doctor Who that's bad. It's just not very good. And there are like 300 stories that are better than it. It's dreadful. It's watchable, which is more than I can say for Underworld, but it's kind of watchable on its own terms, but it's not very good. No, absolutely not. And I wouldn't put it on a list of the top 60 at all.
So move bridging to the second question with the preface that there's a difference between best stories and favorite stories. Mm-hmm. Is the Twin Dilemma on your personal list of your 60 favorite Doctor Who stories of all time?
Absolutely not. With the caveat that I have tremendous nostalgia towards watching it for the first time, and Nicola Bryant in that outfit pretty much did it for me when I was 15 years old. Those things aside, no, absolutely not.
Now this is where I'm going to get a text from Barsky. Graham is exactly right.
Tell Barsky to call me sometime. I miss the man.
Well, I'm seeing him at Galley next week, or as this goes out, I have already spoken to Barsky and hopefully hung out and hopefully got some footage of him on this show, because his cameo last year, it was hilarious. And he's not coming up on the rotation for a while. So that brief interview with him at Galley will be slash was one of his few appearances out of a long stretch. Third question, if someone has not seen The Twin Dilemma, and yes, this is a niche podcast, and the idea that somebody listening has not seen The Twin Dilemma is probably impossible. If a listener has not seen The Twin Dilemma, do you recommend they pause the podcast, go to their streaming app of choice, whether it's iPlayer in the UK or Tubi here in the States, watch The Twin Dilemma, come back, and listen to the rest of the show?
No. Why would I? That would be suborning torture. I would never do that, Jason.
Here's the thing, though. You cannot experience pleasure unless you've experienced pain first. And as Sylvester McCoy teaches us in The Happiness Patrol, you cannot experience happiness unless you are a killjoy first.
I think there are plenty of miserable experiences I would recommend well before I recommended The Twin Dilemma, I have to say.
Twin Dilemma on TV misfires in so many key ways that I think you need to watch it to understand how good the rest of Doctor Who is in comparison. And yes, I recommend you only watch it once, but there are two great things about Twin Dilemma on TV that should be seen. Can you guess what they are? Apart from Nicola Bryant's costume, that's a given.
Yeah, okay. No, I can't.
Number one, the police station in part one has wood paneled walls and multiple video screens. It's one of the best set design choices on the show. And it's only like one screenshot, but it really is very pleasing to the eye. Wood paneled walls, and I'm a child of the 70s. Yeah. Wood paneled walls are always the answer.
Okay, so the counterpoint on the design front is the fact that when the computer the two twins are playing is basically a mechanical version of Pac-Man. From about 1982, it isn't even a video game version of it. It's actually one where you kind of move an LED light that's got sort of a certain number of spaces and it lights up depending on which direction you move the thing in. I remember this because I went to a private school for a year and one of the kids had it and they played it like incessantly, and it was shaped like an arcade box, and they actually use it as like the computer screen on that thing. So Yes to that, and also yes, as Nick Abadzis once pointed out to me, that the fact that the spaceship effects are actually quite good. You know, so like the actual spaceships are actually quite cool looking. But yeah, then they use Pac-Man.
And the second point in its favor, we think of Colin Baker the way that he has looked for most of his adult life. We think of him the way that the camera doesn't exactly flatter him in Trial of a Time Lord a couple of years later. He is in his early 40s. He is in great physical shape, and he literally leaps over a sofa in part two. Very few doctors up to that point in the show's history were capable of that sort of athleticism. And it's great to see him young and in his prime, and the future is ahead of him. And he doesn't realize how much pain this show is going to bring over the next few years, but this is his moment.
I don't dispute that, actually. The thing about The Twin Dilemma is that I don't think it's particularly good, but I don't think I think it's actually enjoyable to watch. When you watch it, it's fine. You know, I get through it, it's done, and then I turn it off and I go, what the hell did I just watch? But while I'm watching it, I'm enjoying it. And one of the things I do enjoy is how much Colin Baker is putting into the sort of energy he's putting into it, as you say. That is great. I will grant you that. I don't think he particularly has a sense of what character he's playing, and I think there's a few things that are off with that. And I think Colin is about a season away from actually kind of zeroing in on what a good Doctor portrayal is. But yeah, the energy he's putting into it is undeniable.
And he was not served by having to report to JNT, who never knew what he wanted out of the character and gave some bonkers ideas. According to our mutual friend Shannon Patrick Sullivan's website, Brief History of Time Travel, the idea for the Doctor and Perry to hate each other was a JNT idea, which may have to go down as the worst idea in the long, sad history of bad ideas. And then Eric Sayward, who spent much of season 22 passive-aggressively sniping at the choices that Colin Baker made playing an assassin in Blake 7 a few years earlier. So he was hamstrung by the fact that the two people running the show had horrible ideas for his character, so he didn't necessarily have a fair shot at playing the Doctor he wanted until Big Finish 20 years later, and now he's one of the most favorite Doctors ever.
I have a more complicated and nuanced response to that. Let's say complicated. I mean, nuanced is in the eye of the beholder, I suppose. I think on the one hand, I think the problem is that you can only react to a reaction once and then you do it. Like, and I think we had the same problem in the modern show. We managed to get out of that scrape a lot better. But, but the thing is that when they cast Peter Davison, they were casting against Tom Baker. They are casting against, this older, very imposing, larger than life figure with a young, very naturalistic, very kind of instinctive actor who was very, very, who was very lovely and pleasant and just brought beaming intelligence to charm to the role of the Doctor. I'm a tremendous fan of Peter Davison. He's one of my favorite Doctors. It's a great idea. And then kind of like the same way that they really cast Matt Smith to contrast against David Tennant, when you've got the same person doing it again, you're having to react against a choice that you made to react against someone else's casting. And that becomes more problematic. With Peter Capaldi, they could have hit a bad skid. They pulled out of it. And to a certain extent, I think they came up with some of their better ideas in Capaldi's second season. But with Colin, the reaction against reaction was, let's give him a costume that deliberately clashes. Let's make him deeply unpleasant. Let's have him be angry and fight against and be arrogant. And it's not so because it contrasts with Peter Davison's sweetness. It's not a very good conception, I think. It's the worst possible starting point for casting a Doctor. I also think, I'll take the mail for it, guys. I also think Colin Baker is miscast. I still think he's miscast. I think he is a brilliant character actor. I think he is very good at taking any script that he's given and just sort of giving it life and giving it us all, and it's amazing. I don't think he necessarily is a lead. He doesn't necessarily approach a lead role with that sort of overall conception of the character, and this is how I'm going to do it. Like, Peter Davison's Doctor is given some very unpleasant things to do. Like when he's has to just go take a gun and go hunt a Dalek mutant in Resurrection of the Daleks. When he gives back the gun to the soldiers after that hunt is over, he holds it like it's a live snake. It's a very, very deliberately nuanced choice on the part of that actor to sort of say, no, my character doesn't like violence generally. He will go do it, but he doesn't. Colin's like, oh, I'm told to go pump the cyber leader with things. I'd do it again and again. I'd stand over him. Like, that's literally a quote from an interview with Colin Baker and me. He just went for it because that's what the script was given to him. And I kind of feel like this myth of he was underserved by his scripts until Big Finish came back is basically it's a myth, because I think really what the deal is that Big Finish was written by people who really desperately wanted to redeem Colin Baker's Doctor. Not because I think Colin Baker played it any differently. He was just given scripts where he didn't have to do things. So sorry about that. You're gonna have to bleep that. But yeah, that's kind of that's basically what I think is the deal. And you know, I think he's a marvelous actor. I think he's a tremendous elder statesman for Doctor Who fandom in general. I think there is no one better at a convention. I just think he was really miscast from the get-go.
Jim Sangster made a very good point on this show a while back, or maybe it was in private conversation. I can't remember anymore. So much for that.
I'll bring it together with Jim. I understand that, believe me.
So with season 17, they lost the last episode of the season because of industrial action. With season 20, they lost the last episode of the season due to industrial action. Yeah. If they lost the last episode of Peter Davison's final season due to industrial action, then Peter Davison doesn't get a regeneration story. And that is why Peter Davison bows out with the penultimate story of season 21, because if they had to lose the final episode of the season, they're losing the first episode of a new Doctor that can be replaced, rather than the final episode of a Doctor who is no longer under contract and cannot be replaced. So you have to end season 21 with Colin Baker's first story. That makes sense. The two things that leave such a sour taste in your mouth as you go to a 10-month hiatus before season 22 is the strangling of Perry, which is literally the worst choice the show ever made.
Yep.
And the N-word and a Celestial Toymaker not being a choice, but rather an actor going off script. And the other problem is the episode ends with the Doctor sneering at Perry. I am the Doctor, whether you like it or not. And the natural response is she should have punched him in the face with the right cross, but instead she smiles, which is poor scripting, poor directing. And all this is happening over the span of 8 days, all four episodes air, and then you have 10 months to go before the next season. You're like, wow, I don't think I like this show anymore. Had two other people, other than J&T and Sayward, given us a first script for the Colin Baker era, regardless of whether or not Colin Baker is the right choice for the lead, we are much more charitably inclined to him. Perhaps.
It's hard to say. Like, you know, if had the Twin Dilemma been the first episode of the 1985 season, would it have been a better thing? Part of me would like to say yes, because it might have given Sayward more time to figure out a script. Given Anthony Stephen was dying when he wrote his draft, and
when his typewriter exploded was his excuse to the production office.
Yes. So, you know, I think there's a lot going on that with Anthony Stephen that, you know, maybe may have been rectified, and maybe Sayward would have taken a greater hand in the thing. Maybe we could have gotten a script that was like the novelization, which I love. That's all entirely possible. On the other hand, the counterpoint is, we waited till 1985 to start Colin Baker era. It could have been just about as bad as Attack of the Cybermen, which I frankly think is worse than the Twin Dilemma. And I actually do get angry every time I watch it, because I just go, how can Doctor Who be this bad? And it's just like, let's play the nostalgia hits and let's do everything kind of the most tone dead way possible, and it's just very, very kind of all over the map, and it doesn't really, and it's got Colin's Doctor being hugely thuggish and violent throughout, and it's just not pleasant. And so I kind of go, yeah, it's that argument. You know, if Peter Davison had continued, you know, maybe we could have gotten more of what we got in Caves, or we could have gotten Peter Davison in Time Lash. It's kind of like six of one, half a dozen the other, like, you know.
I will tell you this about Attack of the Cybermen. Before the pandemic, when I did my pilgrimage, I was on this kick where I'd pick a random 1980s story, watch the DVD, read the novelization, and write up both for Stacy Smith's ratings guide. Mm-hmm. This is before the pandemic, so about 5 years ago now. And I drew the unlucky straw that said Attack of the Cybermen, a story of which I am very much not fond of. And that's coming up quite a way down the rotation here. It's one of the last novelizations. We're only on book 103, so it'll be the end of 2024 before we get to that, and we're still in the winter of our discontent. But I decided to do what Lou Anders does, our mutual friend, author Lou Anders. When he watches a movie, he's talked about this on his blog, he will put a pen and paper next to him and he will write down what happens in each scene. And he learns the structure of scripting that way, because things happen in a certain order and they reach a certain progression and you can graph it on an XY axis. I decided to do the same thing for Attack of the Cybermen because I was expecting to hate it and I wanted to track down scene by scene exactly where it went wrong. Right. What I found is, number one, you have Matthew Robinson as the director, and he was very, very insistent on short, propulsive scenes.
Yeah.
Novelization is very different. There's a lot of padding on TV, especially in part one. All that is taken out of the novelization, which reads very, very differently, but that's a story for another podcast. All of the diamond heist stuff works really, really well. Now, of course, every other 45 seconds, you cut back to the Doctor and Perry arguing and making exactly zero displacement on the plot.
Yeah.
But the stuff with Terry Molloy and Morris Colborn and the great Brian Glover, and I forget who the fourth fellow is, but he's the first one to die, so don't worry about him too much. All that stuff was very good. But then you get to part two and Bates and Stratton sniping at each other on Telos, and I really wasn't a big fan of the Kryons, and they were meant to be an allegory for the plight of the Native American here in the States, and I don't think it works in any way.
You don't see me cringing, dear listener, when I hear that.
Attack of the Cybermen has problems. I wouldn't say that it's worse than Twin Dilemma, but I understand where you're coming from when you say that.
That's like saying, you know, I'm going to put half my face in boiling water. I'm going to put half my face in scalding steam. Which one blisters more? Like, who cares? Your face is messed regardless.
That worked out very well for Aaron Eckhart in The Dark Knight. So
I did the most Sayward-esque metaphor there, too.
All right. Happier tidings. Indeed. Did you first encounter the Twin Dilemma novelization, or as you say in Canada, novelization?
Novelization. I encountered it it was before it came out on TV. And it came out, I think I saw it on TV for the first time in 86. So probably saw this in late 85, I think. And I was in high school and I was just turning 16. And we had a bookshop called Pick of the Crop Books and Toys. And they had like kids' toys upstairs, and they had a kids' bookshop in the bottom, and they had all the Doctor Who books. And I bought the War Games there in 1984, and it was like one of the first Target novelizations I bought with my own money, and it was wonderful. And so, anyways, they had the Twin Dilemma there, and I was like, ooh, it hadn't aired on PBS here. I hadn't seen it. I had seen the two Doctors. I had a friend of mine give me like a seventh generation copy of it from the BBC. So I got to see the two Doctors. So I'd seen Colin's Doctor, but I hadn't actually, you know, watched any of the other stories. And I certainly hadn't seen the Twin Dilemma. So I was very, very, so I was like, I got to get that. And I managed to somehow engineer my schedule that year so that I had a spare in my last period, and I had lunch and then I had a spare. So effectively I was off school as of 2:30 in the afternoon. So I basically went there at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, saw the Twin Dilemma and got on bus and went home and read it all weekend. So that's kind of how I encountered it. And yeah, I mean, it was love at first sight. I just love this novelization. It's probably one of my very favorites.
That sounds delightful, by the way. Getting to leave high school 90 minutes early, know, going to a toy shop, reading a Doctor Who book on the bus. I would have loved that lifestyle.
Yep. I spent way too many times just going to comic book stores instead of going home.
I had jobs throughout my last 2.5 years of high school. And I originally started off at a movie theater that was on the far end of our subdivision. And it was a very long walk. And the manager, who as of a couple of years ago was still around managing another movie theater on Long Island, and she had to have been about 130 years old. Difficult person to work for. So I changed jobs and I got a job at our local library, which was directly behind our house. So a 2-minute walk.
That's nice.
Now this is that was making $4.05 an hour, and then minimum wage went up to $4.25. So I was making pennies on the dollar, but working in the library was delightful. But I was at school between 7:40 and 2:20, got home, had time for a quick snack, worked between 3 and 6, then had to come home and do all my homework and watch all my TV. So if you read my high school diary, it is a chronicle of how exhausted I was. Only getting about six hours of sleep a night, which inculcated some pretty bad habits later in life. But I also, if I wasn't working 3 to 6, I was working the closing shift 6 to 9, which means you come home, do your homework, go to work and miss most of your TV, and then come home and have a late dinner, and that throws off your circadian rhythm. So you had a much more civilized high school experience than I salute you. That sounds wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I did have jobs, but I tended to work on weekends. I did cleaning at my church, and I mowed lawns, and I did other things, but it was all weekend based. So I never had like afternoon jobs. So it was kind of cool. I mostly hung out with friends, but I also went to a lot of comic book shops, and it was good fun. It was good fun. And yeah, it was a great time to be a Doctor Who fan because, you know, we're in that 80s boom where like there was literally like new Target novels every month. And it was really exciting. It's that sort of period between like novel number 80 and number, you know, 110, that it's just like, oh, this is so cool. And then all of a sudden, call crashed in like 87 or 88 when like Lyle Stewart stopped distributing or something like that. And we couldn't get them for like a couple of years. And yeah, so, but it was exciting up until that point.
We are still in the boom times because we are about to reach the three companions books. The first of those comes out after book 106, between books 106 and 107. So we're very close to that.
Yeah.
And then you have the missing season 23 novelizations, which come a little bit further on down the road. So we have a lot of bonus books coming up. We are going to cover those in publication order. So you have this very enjoyable experience leaving school early, buying this brand new fresh novelization. So the nostalgia of childhood is a powerful thing. And the things you like at 11 are much more important than the things that you like at 50. Does the novelization still work for you as well as it did in 1984? And then I want you to tell us what is so great about the novelization.
Yes. The answer to the question is yes. What is so great about the novelization is twofold for me. One, I think what many people criticize about it is not a bug, but a feature. I do love that it's a Douglas Adams pastiche. I do think it, to take one of the most well-known blood and guts kind of I'm gonna make Doctor Who a big violent adventure show. Script editors to Doctor Who and to basically say, you know what, I want my scripts to have tons of comedy, dark comedy in it, and I want it to be discursive and have lots of interesting digressions is to coin a phrase, a baller move. I just think it's amazing. I just love that element of it. I love the tone of it. I love the fact that it opens by, you know, going into this lengthy digression and explaining what regeneration is. And it's all due to like this hormone called the Lindos. And it's, and, you know, giving us the story of Counselor Hearn, who like, you know, regenerates into a very handsome man and then regenerates into someone ugly and then tries to successively improve, but he ends up turning into a blob. And I just thought all that stuff hilarious when I was, and I still did. I reread that bit like tonight, and I was going, "Oh my god, I forgot how great that is." The other thing I just like about it is, I'm not one of those people. He says, trying to desperately remember what he said in his previous appearances on this podcast. I'm not one of those people who generally tends to say, the book is so much better. Like, you know, Castrovella is better than the television serial, but it doesn't supplant it in my mind. It doesn't make me wish Castrovella could have been as imagistic and as intriguing as Christopher Bidmean's gloriously written novel. I don't tend to say that about the TV productions. I don't tend to say, oh, if only it could have been as good as the novelization. I generally tend to like go, you know, they're Doctor Who and Exciting Adventures of the Daleks is a very great story. Doctor Who, the Daleks, Serial B, is also very good. They're for different reasons. And I kind of just go with that. The Twin Dilemma is my one exception to that rule. For me, if the script had actually followed kind of the logic that Sayward does in it, I would have blown the door. It would have been the greatest regeneration story ever. It would have been the greatest first story of a Doctor's era ever, because it decides to give the Doctor interiority, and you're actually getting in a sense of what the Doctor's headspace is, and you're getting a sense of what an unstable regeneration is. It's freaking scary. It's like, you know, the Doctor is constantly going through fugue states. He thinks he's Sherlock Holmes. He thinks he's this, he thinks he's that. And the great thing about this, the novelization, is it situates what those fugue states are, and you understand it. Whereas it's just different varieties of Colin Baker shouting in the TV version. Whereas you kind of wish that the draft that Sayward had done after Anthony Stephen had to step aside, you kind of wish that he just brought in all that kind of interiority that he was clearly going for, like, you know, lines of dialogue where the Doctor is very, very directly quoting from Sherlock Holmes, or lines of dialogue that sort, or just points of view shots where the Doctor is looking at Perry and she's all distorted and horrible, and things that make the horrible thing. Unfortunately, it's directed by Peter Moffat, so not going to happen in this or any other universe where Peter Moffat exists. But that's the problem with the story on TV, is that the Doctor does terrible things, and the Doctor is horrible and shouty and is just miserable and difficult, but you don't ever have a sense of what is motivating him in his interior that is causing that. And they give that the Doctor that motivation, and it's really great. And it made me appreciate, and maybe that's why I kind of give the story way more of a pass than I normally would other stories that are not terribly well directed and not terribly well realized and not terribly well acted. I tend to give this one a lot more of a pass because I have the novelization always in my head, and it's genuinely great. And I love the prose of it. I'm a prose guy. So one of my favorite lines of all time in any novel, period, is the opening of chapter one, which says, "The house stood on Lytle Street. It was a part of a beautifully preserved Georgian terrace. Its graceful facade is pleasing today as when it was first built in 1810, some 500 years earlier." And I just love that. It's like, it like situates when the novel is, without us saying you are in the future. It's actually, you know, relying on your ability to do math to figure out when the story is situated. I love prose like that. I love the kind of cleverness of it. The one time I did meet Eric Sayward, it was a very brief meeting. I was at he came to Toronto for a convention that we held. There's a sort of one day event that was held for him there, and I was a contributing member. And so I got to have dinner with him, and I just sort of told him how much I loved that opening line, and he kind of stared at me like, "Who are you and what are you talking about?" But it was nice nonetheless. Like, I still love it.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because first lines are an important feature of this show. Both Fraser Gregory and Andrew Smith have given me first line quizzes, and I've of course crushed them. But the first line of a book is a very important point, because if the first line of the book works, the book works. If the first line of the book is terribly written, you're immediately put off. As I told you, I've also had to read Timelash this same week because I'm recording live about it at Galley.
I'm so sorry.
That'll be a couple of episodes after this one. "A purple haze glistened upon the conglomeration of pyramids that made up the planet Carful's principal city." Run-on sentence, purple prose. This is not – also, what is this story about? So that sentence is not helpful.
Yeah.
You're right. The first sentence of Twin Dilemma is lovely.
It really is. And I think a lot of the prose in it is very good that way. Like, there's a wonderful bit towards the end where he reminisces on Adric. And it's sort of Sayward just basically kind of contextualizing what Adric was and kind of making it clear that, you know, he was an annoying kid that nobody liked. And when he died, everyone kind of felt sad because he was an annoying kid that nobody liked and never quite felt like they ever warmed to. And that made his death all the harder. And I just kind of love the way he told that story. And it's one of those things, I liked the Visitation novelization pretty fine when I read it when I was 15 years old, but this one was like, oh, this is really cool. And I love Slipback for that reason. I'm not big on Attack so much, but this one and Slipback are really great. I really felt like he was just enjoying the idea of basically writing a novel for the sake of it. And I kind of appreciate that.
I think the first paragraph of Visitation is equally strong because it's a wilderness scene and it's a fox hunting a smaller animal. And the first paragraph concludes with a sentence, "It was the first kill of the evening." And that's the story right there, because pretty soon three humans are about to be killed by the pteroleptals and their androids. There's a line that is so good that Eric Saward reuses it in the 21st century when he's writing his novelization of Revelation of the Daleks.
That's true.
I have two reservations about this book. Number one has nothing to do with the book itself, because this book is now nearly 40 years old. But I think Doctor Who has gone to the Douglas Adams well once too often, as if to say, remember, Douglas Adams was ours before he was Douglas Adams. Remember us. So they put his name on the cover of books, and so many books are written to be intentional Douglas Adams pastiches. You can only do that so many times. And if you have 10 books come out over a period of years that are all Douglas Adamsing, I just don't think it works. Eric Saward got there first. So I think that criticism doesn't apply to him. So my second reservation is a more valid one. Every story in this book, and there's a lot of digressions. There is the Time Lord who regenerates too many times. There is the professor who turns himself into a bottle of Voxnik. Every anecdote has a cynical, black comic ending that results in somebody dies. If you are an anecdote in an Eric Saward book, you better take out a healthy life insurance policy for your loved ones.
Again, I it's funny. I know that, and I as soon as you said it, I nodded, but I also kind of went, yeah, but I like it. I like the morbidly comic side of it. It's funny because when I read Evelyn Waugh for the first time when I was in university, and I read it without knowing that Saward basically filched from a loved one for Revelation of the Daleks. But when I read it, I just kind of I also saw another literary source for Saward, because I just love that kind of mordant black comedy. And I think it's fine I'm just reading his stuff, but that's fine. Like, you know, I read certain authors for certain things, and I read certain authors to get this kind of a sense. I'm doing that even in the modern days. Like I read a James Goss novel because he's going to have interesting kind of Adams-ish, but more Adams adjacent kind of popping of ideas and fizzing, and I love that about it. And I read a Gary Russell one because I love reading the kind of straight ahead adventure story that I'm going to get with him, and it's very kind of Terrence-y pastiche. With Saward, I was kind of like, I like the Visitation fine. I found it very functional. I found it, but it has to have great prose, but I just love his darkly comic ones. I love, and for me, you know, I mean, I love The Twin Dilemma. I love Slipback. And as near as I can tell, Slipback is basically just this massive atmosphere of pus and dark corridors. And it's just, the radio story is terrible. It's really rubbish, but the novelization is brilliant, and part of that is just that he just decides to write his own novel and then bolt this Doctor Who story on the end of it. I'm not bothered by that, I guess, that was what I'm saying, Jason. I understand what you're saying, but I just don't care.
My favorite American TV series of the 21st century is Better Call Saul. I've talked a lot about it on this show.
Yes.
Better Call Saul, in fact, has two Doctor Who connections via two directors from the first season of the show, one of whom directed An Adventure in Space and Time, and another of whom was married to Verity Lambert. So Better Call Saul is also a time travel series, and I actually wrote an essay that I've never finished or published or tried to publish about how Doctor Who would be better served if it took the Better Call Saul time travel model, because on Better Call Saul, the past is in color and the future is in black and white, which is an incredible design aesthetic. Better Call Saul is, and it started off as a black comedy. So what happens to Michael McKean's character over the course of his three seasons on the show? the Howard Hamlin character. Better Call Saul could have been just a black comedy where everything is mean and cynical and everyone meets a fitting nasty end, and it could have been an awful show. Better Call Saul then discovers its humanity, and it sticks to being a black comedy, but it's a black comedy with a heart, and as characters die in increasingly horrible ways throughout the course of the series, not to spoil for those of you who haven't yet had the pleasure of watching, it gives it a real humanity, and it takes time to rehabilitate its characters and make you feel their most painful inner moments, so you are on the side of these characters as terrible things happen to them. I think that's a much better style of storytelling than what happens in Twin Dilemma, not to blame Eric Sayward for not following a TV show that was 30 years in the future as he wrote this.
It's so funny.
I want my black comedy to have a heart, is what I'm saying. This book doesn't have.
I get that. I get that. I mean, he's more of a Breaking Bad guy than a Better Call Saul guy, I think, is basically what it boils down to. I'm not saying you're not wrong in this. I think for me, I just rely on the great diversity of the whole of Doctor Who to balance it out rather than expecting him to actually be something that he's not. Like, you know, he's not a sentimental guy. He's not exactly what I would call a the most entertaining fellow I've ever met in my entire life. So, you know, he's just, you know, but he's just very, you know, he does one thing. He does one thing exceptionally well. I enjoy reading it. I do agree, you know, I count on, you know, I count on the broad tapestry of other Doctor Who novelizations to give me the other things I want, like a Donald Cotton adaptation, like The Romans, or which is coming up soon, or, you know, or even Holmes's Holmes's The Two Doctors, there's all kinds of different parts of Doctor Who novelizations which have, you know, The Massacre is another one. I was recently just paging through and going, oh yeah, I remember when they did that. You know, I kind of count on the sort of broad tapestry of Doctor Who to kind of fill in those things, and rather than expecting Eric Sayward to be anything other than the dark, mordant person that he clearly is.
And this book does serve a necessary purpose. If you're going to write a book that completely ignores the TV story and shoehorns the plot into two chapters at the end, it just goes off and tells its own whimsical story the rest of the time. This is the story to do it to. If you were to read a straightforward Terrence Dicks 4-square 12-chapter novelization of Twin Dilemma on TV, even if Terrence wrote it, you would never get past chapter 4.
No, you wouldn't. And I think what I like about it is, someone once told me that they had a conversation. I wish I could remember who said it to me, but they told me they actually met like Eric Sayward. This is a few years ago, and before he started sort of resurfacing and doing comics and doing other novelizations. But he had a conversation where he was talking about doing he felt like his main flaw when he did Doctor Who was that when he script edited stories, he tended to try to reflect the voice of the author. Of the writer who was doing it. So he said, you know, when I did Time Lash, I should have just done a page one rewrite. And instead I was desperately trying to ape Glenn McCoy's style instead of actually just doing. And that makes sense to me because, you know, you look at the things where it's documented that Sayward rewrote it, like Snake Dance or like even parts of Kinda. He's really desperately trying to ape Christopher Bailey's style. And so with the Twin Dilemma, I feel like he's hamstrung because he's desperately trying to ape what Anthony Stephen had written in his outline and try and write in Anthony Stephen's style. And Anthony Stephen is actually like, if you watch his other TV work, like All Creatures Great and Small, he's a very warm and human writer. And I don't really think it was really whatever he had in mind for the Twin Dilemma. It wasn't what Sayward had in mind. I kind of wish that Sayward had just basically taken the safeties off and just written what he wrote in the novelization. I think it could have been so much better and so much more interesting. And all the elements are there. They're just more interesting. Like, you know, I like the fact that Hugo Drax basically does the changing his character every episode like he does in the TV story. It's just more better motivated. and Drax gets more interesting things to reflect on while he's doing it. This, you know, Archie Sylvester is actually a way more interesting character than Dinner's Jennery plays. You know, I just love the paranoia that he's clearly living with, and you know, I just kind of feel like he needed to basically kind of write that, you know, he kind of needed to be more like Robert Holmes rewriting Pyramids of Mars than you know, Eric Sayward rewriting Anthony Stephen, in my view.
Or Terrence Dix rewriting The Mutants.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Terrence had this rule that you had three drafts, and if you couldn't get it right by the third draft, he was going to write it for you. And that probably should have happened in Time Lash, and it probably should have happened here. But like you say, Eric Sayward wanted to honor the people who submitted those first drafts. I'm sure he'd do that one over again if he could. And that's – he had to do so much work on season 22. I think that Time and – Mark of the Ronnie and Two Doctors are the only stories that he wasn't writing himself every single page.
I think so, yeah. I think
tremendous
so,
burden on him. He was supposed to be at Galley next week or last week, depending on your point of view. But he canceled, so I had a lot of questions to ask him, and sadly that will not be the case. But Kevin McNally will be there, so maybe I'll get Kevin McNally to autograph my book.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great. I mean, I'm kind of glad that Kevin McNally had this great resurgence in Drax, in Flux, because I feel like he was owed, and he is like easily the best thing about Flux. So I'm kind of very delighted that he's actually going to Galley. So
I should point out that I've been recording four interviews out of order. This episode is going out Super Bowl Sunday, so before I go to Galley. So stay tuned next week for the first of my live Galley episodes with Stacey Smith. But yes, I am sorry that Eric Sayward is not going to be there. Matthew Waterhouse is going to be there, and I'm very excited about that.
Oh, I'll be good. He's always good value as an interview, in my opinion. And I think especially in the past 10-15 years, I think he's kind of reconnected the fandom in a way, and I think he's kind of developed like his novel is not for everybody, but I did enjoy large swathes of it, so I kind of feel like I do kind of feel like you know, I'm glad he's kind of figuring that part of his life out, you know, so yeah, I'm glad he's back in the fold.
And what's in store for you, Graham? What are we going to be seeing from you in the coming weeks and months?
At this point, just doing Reality Bomb, I think, is mostly what's up. There is talk about me going back to the world of Doctor Who biography, but it's very, very early days. We're still having some chats. I will be in the book that they're doing on the DNA of the Philip Hinchcliffe years that Cutaway Press is doing for various reasons. The biography with Philip didn't quite happen, but so they decided to do a essays in tribute of him, and they're using the interviews that I did for it, so which I'm very pleased about. Gary Russell's doing a bang-up job on editing it, so I'm really, really looking forward to seeing how that turns out. Otherwise, I've been kind of quiet. I actually have a day job right now that actually requires me to be very, very busy in that, and I've had a bunch of family things come up, so as a result, I haven't been as active in terms of fandom things as I normally, or even writing things as I usually have been. I'm hoping that will change, and certainly I'm starting to have preliminary conversations that will change that. In the meantime, it's just gonna be Reality Bomb. I'm looking forward to getting back into the saddle to go do a new episode probably in the next couple of weeks, and probably gonna take a month or two off in April or May, but otherwise we'll be around, and we'll sort of be around in time for the show coming back. Probably, you know, in May, once the show comes back, we'll be well ready for Shruti Gatwa. I'm very excited about the season ahead, and I'm just kind of, it's kind of nice. I have to say, I wasn't that, I mean, I always loved Doctor Who, but I wasn't that enamored with the past several seasons. So I'm just happy to be really excited about Doctor Who again, which is nice, and that sort of feeling of being able to sit down at my TV at like, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday and, you know, and suddenly hear the theme song. And like the first time the Starbeast aired, that theme song started and I just screamed yes at the top of my lungs. It was very unseemly, but it felt very good. And it feels good to be back there again. So yeah, I'm very excited.
And your Reality Bomb editorial on the structure of the theme song and what you like about the newest version is also a must listen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, it came off so much better in the actual version on the show. I really, really like how they have actually structured it. I love the title sequence. That is such a cool title sequence. So it really works quite perfectly for me. Yeah. I was really surprised because I have to say I was kind of like, I mean, the conclusion I came in the editorial was, you know, it's Murray Gold. He's not really paying attention to the electronic, but hey, it's exciting. And now I'm like, no, I'm totally sold on board. This is great. I really want exciting. Thank you.
The adrenaline rush of the Doctor Who opening credits is always one of the biggest selling points of the show, because after those 30 or 45 seconds, you are all in, even before the story has started.
Oh, absolutely. So,
especially with the Peter Howell theme, which is still probably my favorite, when you start off the Twin Dilemma with 30 seconds of Peter Howell, how could you be in a bad mood? Eric Sandwich says, hold my beer. But at least you'll always have those first 30 seconds.
It's interesting. I love the Peter Howell version, first of all. They're like, for me, the Peter Howell version is possibly the most, my favorite revision of the theme song is that one. I just love that, you know, sound, and it just immediately, it was nostalgic, but it's also just really good, well-realized music. But it's also, but the funny thing about it is that watching the Colin Baker era graphics, they actually didn't want him to do the wink that McCoy did, and they actually did photograph him doing the wink. And you can see, and if you look around hard enough, you can probably find it. I've seen it. And so every time I watch the thing where he does that really lame smile, I go, yeah, they were cowards. They should have had him wink.
That wink would not have worked given what he has to do in Twin Dilemma and Attack of the Cybermen. That would be kind of cognitive dissonance. If they had written his character differently, maybe yes, but it wouldn't work as the character was portrayed.
Cognitive dissonance is the name of Colin Baker's tribute band, frankly. So, you know, I'm not...
Well, Graham, I want to thank you so much for taking time out to do this. This was a lot of fun, and I'm glad to hear a positive take on Twin Dilemma, even if we can't quite salvage the television story.
Yeah, that's all right. I mean, I'm sure there's someone around. I mean, I give it a touch on my friend Ari. He's a giant defender of the Twin Dilemma, the actual TV version. He thinks it is utterly brilliant, and I have spent many Shabbat meals arguing with him about this, actually. So I will happily put you in touch with him.
Well, that's certainly a new sentence that somebody just said. Passionate defender of the Twin Dilemma.
And other things, too. But
well, tonight is Thursday. Shabbat is tomorrow. So I imagine he's not available until Saturday. But put me in touch.
I will. Anyways, it is always a delight, Jason. It's always so much fun to talk to you about Doctor Who. So, yeah, thanks for having me on.
And we'll have you back on very soon, hopefully. Have a great night.
Thanks very much.
Doctor Who, The Twin Dilemma, by Eric Sayward. Televised as The Twin Dilemma. Teleplay by Eric Sayward, from a draft by Anthony Stephen, and with ideas suggested by Ian Levine and John Nathan Turner. Screen credit to Anthony Stephen. Televised in March 1984. Paperback release date, March 13th, 1986. Target book number 103. Cover artist, Andrew Skilleter. The Doctor has regenerated, having sacrificed his fifth persona to save Perry's life. But things are not going well. On this occasion, the process of regeneration is by no means smooth, for the even-tempered, good-humored Fifth Doctor has given way to a rather disturbed and unsettled successor. In a particularly irascible moment, the new Doctor comes dangerously close to committing a shocking crime. Overwhelmed with guilt for his violent behavior, the repentant Time Lord decides to become a hermit. How do you solve a problem like the Twin Dilemma? How do you take Classic Who's acknowledged worst episode ever and turn it into a book that people will buy, let alone read? This is a scary but also somewhat liberating prospect. To date, Eric Saward's only other novelization has been The Visitation, episode 70 of this podcast, which was an excellent traditional book. The Visitation followed its camera scripts to the letter and weaved in mature and nuanced prose. And it was based on a pretty good story, at least as I rate them. But Twin Dilemma on TV is not a pretty good story, and its camera scripts were presumably a mess of crossouts, corrections, and deleted scenes. So it's not a surprise that Saward produces a book that bears no relation to the tone and style of his first one. Instead, he ignores both the TV plot and script for Twin Dilemma and goes the full Douglas Adams with a satiric, mocking book that spends 80% of its time on acerbic tangents, and the rest of its time having the main characters comment on how absurd is the plot. This causes problems structurally because the TV plot is wafer thin, coming into play really only at the end of part 3. But the novelization is so front-loaded with Saward's Adams-esque riffs that by the time he reaches the big plot revelation, he's already used up most of his allotted page count, and there are very few pages left with which to address that, well, plot, such as it is. Now, you do not blame Eric Saward for going the experimental route. Don't get me wrong. If there's any Doctor Who TV story that deserves to be ignored and to have a very different book, Twin Dilemma is that story. I don't necessarily love the end result of the novelization, for reasons that Graham and I discussed earlier, but I do love that the target bookline takes risks like this and goes so out of left field, to use another sports ball metaphor. Chapter 1 is a self-contained short story about a man named Archie Sylvester, a character played for two scenes on TV by Dennis Chinnery, a.k.a. Garman from Genesis of the Daleks, and also an American merchant ship captain in 1965's The Chase. Sylvester, in the book, and only in the book, is a brilliant mathematician who hates his twin sons and has been encouraged by his psychiatrist to plot their perfect murder, purely as a therapeutic exercise. He lives in an expensive Georgian mansion in 24th century London, is addicted to an alcoholic beverage called Voxnik, and is having an affair with a woman whose husband rings his doorbell and breaks his face at the end of the chapter. And by the way, I missed a trick earlier when asking Graham about his beverage for the night. Forgot to ask him if that was Voxnik he was drinking. Now, of course, none of this Archie Sylvester material matters by the final chapter, chapter 10, but it is bold and different, especially for a regeneration story where you would think you'd want to meet the Doctor on the first page. Chapter 2 is largely an irreverent, again, firmly tongue-in-cheek look at Time Lord regenerations, owing much to the first five Douglas Adams penned minutes of Destiny of the Daleks than to anything else in Doctor Who ever. The story of Counselor Verne and his regeneration misadventures is comically awful, but taken literally, not the kind of true story you want in your Doctor Who headcanon. The Sixth Doctor complaining about the just-regenerated Fifth, feckless and effete, sounds like Saward being cruel and spiteful about Peter Davison. But Saward is not kinder to Collins' J&T selected wardrobe. Quote, "Now it can be said that the Doctor's taste had never been haute couture, but the jacket and trousers which he had decided suited his new persona should have warned Perry of something. They were the choice of a maladjusted personality." And by the way, in a book with terrific chapter titles, that is Chapter 2, The Maladjusted Time Lord. Later on, Perry laments of the Doctor's new volcanic personality, quote, "She now wished he had killed her. At least that would have been quick." That's a funny sense, but not warmly funny. That's kind of cruel and bullying funny. And rather than burying the inept mistake that was the Doctor trying to strangle Perry, Sayward describes the attempted murder in graphic detail, although one might argue that violent misogyny is just another day at the office for Eric Sayward, circa 1984. Sayward doesn't get to the earliest origins of the TV plot until Chapter 3, but bizarrely chooses to narrate Professor Edgeworth's abduction of the title twins through the eyes of a ginger tomcat, spending a couple of pages explaining why cats are the most intelligent creatures in the universe. Well, no argument there. Speaking of which, say hi to Smudge, who is literally lying across my keyboard, trying to attack my hand as I record this. In the same chapter, Perry remarks that if the Doctor wants to seek hermitage in a deserted place, he should choose, quote, downtown New York. Now that paragraph hasn't aged well. Downtown hasn't been desolate for a long time. Regards, the guy who works in the West Village. Sayward reveals, much earlier than on TV, Edgeworth's true identity as Asmael, and secret plan to avenge Jacanda by killing Mestor. The story of Asmael's Time Lord past is ludicrous, but interestingly, almost perfectly presages the plot of Trial of a Time Lord. We are well into Chapter 5, nearly halfway through the book, when Sayward stops Adamsing, temporarily, and gets back to the plot. He rushes through the Part 1 cliffhanger, though this at least has the advantage of eliminating all the woeful TV dialogue of Colin and Nicholas sniping at one another. A later scene where the Doctor drops to his knees and cowardly hides behind Perry, then blames his intrusion on her, is also axed. So that's actually a good thing. Much of the TV narrative beats are missing. In fact, including the Chamberlain, one of the only interesting characters from the Jacanda half of the story on TV, parts 3 and 4.
Listen, young sir, this planet's finished. There's no future here.
Shut up.
But you don't understand. Here we have a fine craft to take us away from here. Far away.
I said shut up.
But we must get away from here.
He can't fly the TARDIS, but we could learn.
I'll take you all. You're a true gentleman, sir.
Wait a minute, I remember you. You're the Chamberlain.
Yes, that's right, sir.
I don't like you.
But, sir, I must get away from here.
Then I suggest you start walking.
Instead, the Chamberlain is mentioned only in one short passage at the end and is arbitrarily named Slarn, a name Sayward will reuse later. Also lost in print are the only two non-Perry female roles at Hugo Lang's Police HQ from the Part 1 material. I guess that's what Sayward decided was really the problem with Twin Dilemma all along. It's female characters. By the time Sayward invents a history for Titan III, Thou Craggy Knob, which involves people reading Mein Kampf for light entertainment and committing mass suicide, you're almost ready to subject yourself to the same fate, or at least accidentally transform yourself into a bottle of booze. Another Sayward anecdote. Better are subtle references to vintage pop culture, such as one to the now-forgotten adventure novelist Raphael Sabatini, the muse of swashbuckle-era silent Hollywood. There's a long riff on Sherlock Holmes in Chapter 6, which Graham told us about earlier, with the Doctor literally adopting the Holmes persona and telling an almost funny story about midwives and childbirth. Also interesting is Perry's observation that the Doctor, should he adopt an evil persona instead, would be impossible to thwart. And that's another prefiguring of Trial of a Time Lord, isn't it? Sayward is very casual with the TV cliffhangers. Quite unlike Galaxy 4, he improves the limp resolution to the Part 1 cliffhanger. The Doctor in the book physically disarms Hugo instead of cowering in fear while Hugo merely falls back asleep. However, he removes the Parts 2 and 3 episode endings entirely, which is no real loss to the story. My biggest issue with the book is that it needs a serious resolution, and doesn't quite get one. After all the cynical humor of the first 8 chapters, the plot is shoehorned into the final 2, given, by the way, the MCU-esque names Endgame Parts 1 and 2. There is a shockingly raw eulogy to Adric, which Graham kindly broke down for us earlier. Page 117. The Doctor stared at the glass partition which separated Mestor's hatchery from the laboratory area and allowed his mind to flick through the many pages of his long memory, hoping some half-forgotten incident might jog his inspiration into solving the current problem. But it didn't. All he seemed able to recall were faces and fragments of incidents, some of which he would rather have forgotten. He recalled Jo Grant with her soft, pretty face, framed by her always perfectly groomed blonde hair. He remembered Tegan, Leela, Zoe, and Jamie. Even Turlough, the only companion who had seriously tried to kill him, flittered in and out of images of Nyssa, Romana, and Liz Shaw. But the image that danced most frequently across the history of time was that of Adric, for he performed the most grotesque caper of all, that of the Dance of Death. Adric, who, despite possessing a mathematical skill equal to the twins, had always managed to aggravate everyone aboard the TARDIS with his childish antics, denying him the thing he desired most, to be loved and accepted for what he was. It was Adric who had been killed whilst trying to divert a freighter controlled by the Cybermen from crashing into prehistoric Earth. Stubborn Adric, who had refused to leave the ship and had given his life to help others. It was this memory that the Doctor feared most. Not only had he been forced to stand helplessly by, but the boy had died without the Doctor ever being able to fully praise, help, or ultimately like. It was these feelings that made Adric the saddest and most painful memory of all. The Doctor shook his head as though trying to shake himself free of the unpleasant image. It wasn't the time to remember such things. He had more urgent problems to occupy his mind. But even then, after that quote, we get pointless and ever more tiresome asides right in the middle of what passes for a climax. Quote, Professor Vinnie Mostyn discovers the acid which bears his name, quite by chance, when on an exhibition to the planet Senile 9. You don't even need to finish that anecdote to know that Professor Vinnie, if that is his real name, doesn't survive the paragraph. Nobody survives an Eric Sayward anecdote. This is a very well-written book. I don't enjoy it quite as much as Graham does, but I like the fact that it takes significant risks with the narrative, and we will see more of that in the coming weeks and months as the Target books go further and further afield from their original remit of preserving the TV stories in amber. The anecdotes show a writer who is capable of focusing his humor, and that page and a half long section about Adric among the other companions, while may have been receiving a boost from Ian Levine on the names and places, it's really good material. The Doctor never being able to tell Adric that he really liked the boy. I'm not sure if that holds true to the Peter Davison Doctor, but the larger point is it's very good prose and it stands out in a book that doesn't always pay strict attention to what's happening on screen with Doctor Who and the Twin Dilemma. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we are going back in time from season 21 to season 3. We are going back in time to a book that I alluded to earlier in this audio essay. We are going back to a novelization that pays very careful attention to the TV cliffhangers. A four-part TV story is reproduced as a four-part book. Next week's episode is also one of three episodes where the interview is, or hopefully by the time they reach you, will have been recorded live at Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles. It is Doctor Who, Galaxy 4. And joining us once again is Professor Stacey Smith. Very excited to hear what she has to say. And we'll be talking about it face-to-face next time on Doctor Who Literature. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Doctor Who Literature. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Graham Burke from Reality Bomb. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's Dr. Who Literature at gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
a Doctor Who Podcast Network.